Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkwan, with the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. And today I have the distinct pleasure of talking with Mani Rao. She's an independent scholar and a poet. And she is, of course, the author of today's feature, Living Mantra, Mantra, Deity, and Visionary Experience Today. Mani, it's such a pleasure to have you on the channel with us.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
I guess the first thing that our listeners might be interested in is a little bit more about yourself, your background, where you come from, that sort of thing.
Well, where I come from, you mean locational, I guess?
I actually meant it open-ended. So back okay. geographical, cultural, educational, as you
will. Okay. Well, primarily I'm a poet and have recently completed a PhD in religious studies from Duke University. A couple of years ago. And I've been studying early Indian sources for the last, I would say, decade or so, before which I was, I guess, I was not doing that. I was doing many other things. But my primary interest in mantra was about a decade ago as well.
Right. So one of the key features I think that'll interest many readers of this book is that you have your own personal interest in and history with mantra. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that before we segue into the content of the book.
Okay. I guess I'll make the connection with poetry because that's how I came into it. I've always been very interested in sound and I've always seen poetry as sort of like a finding the natural form within an art. When we start with something arbitrary and then you sort of discover its natural form is how I've always seen poetry as, and as working with like air architecture, you know, working with sound forms and with it's a temporal form, but at the same time, it's just so based on sound. And then of course, there's the whole language philosophy, the Indian language philosophy of Shabda Brahman, which talks about sound as the medium of creation and material creation. And so I got very interested in the concept when I started reading about it. And when I had an intense encounter with mantra, at first I started trying to appraise that as something aesthetic. Trying to understand if there was some deep aesthetic difference between different mantras and what was the effect of the mantras coming from. And as I got deeper and deeper into it, I actually, one, realized that it had nothing to do with aesthetics, or maybe if it does, that's not the reason for its potency. And then secondly, I also discovered my own reactions and responses and experience of mantra. And that took me deeper into the subject. And so when I started doing a doctoral degree mantra became my first topic of research.
It's quite wonderful that you straddle that line between an embodied practice or something that's personally dear to you, and also something that's become an object of study. Now, for our listeners, this tension is sometimes described in religious studies in various ways. Sometimes we think of it as this idea of, well, they're insiders of religion, they're outsiders of religion.
Mm-hmm.
One may be an insider, but one must view it as an outsider to be religious studies versus theology. And I leave it open-ended as to whether this tension exists in the way we think it exists or whether it exists for you. But I think you're poised to provide some very useful insight in terms of this perceived tension in religious studies.
This is really such a deep question. And for myself, I've actually never known which side I'm on, whether I'm a scholar who's being a practitioner and playing double agent, or whether I'm a practitioner who's trying to get into scholarship in order to have a more informed understanding or a more objective understanding. I'm not sure which it was. But I must say that I am also interested in many topics which are not part of my practice. So therefore, in that sense, I'm a scholar. At the same time, I really don't find much excitement in being a scholar without connecting with whatever it is you're studying. Somehow, ultimately, no matter what topic you pick, you tend to look for things that give you more information or understanding about yourself. That's very, very broad statement. I mean, that applies, I guess, to any topic. I find that, you know, we gravitate towards what tells us more about something deep that we want to find out about ourselves. So the two are really very, very intermingled. And I think it's very hard to separate them. And actually, I don't see why we should separate them.
So this idea that there must be some interest, some deep, profound interest, this resonates a great deal. I think that when there is some profound interest, you're both more an impassioned lecturer as well as a scholar. And really, to complete a dissertation, it has to be more than just jumping through hoops. There has to be something in it for your journey, your intellectual journey, even your personal journey. One thing I want to say to the listeners is that while money clearly has these both perspectives, the book is written as a stringently academic book where she shares her background very forthcomingly with the reader. It's not, the book is not, for example, memoirs of a spiritual journey.
Oh, no.
It's an academic study of three very fascinating sites that we'll come to shortly. But what's interesting is that she can dovetail the two in her being in some way. Having said that, correct me if I'm wrong, but while you're doing the scholarship piece, you're doing it in a different mode than while you're doing the practitioner piece. And so there's a boundary there on some level. Or do you think that's a false boundary?
Talking about the field work, I would say that at different locations, my participation was different, right? So the participation, or rather, it's an anthropology of experience, firstly. So that already creates a certain dynamics. And I think that in this particular topic, in this particular field of research and anthropology of experience of mantra, unless you have some stake in it yourself, how can you discover the questions that actually matter to the people you are studying? You know, I'll give you one example, and then I'll take up something you asked. For example, I would say that before I started practicing mantra, practicing is an odd word, but before I started doing mantra, mantra sadhana, my questions were very, very cold, After I started doing mantra sadhana, I started wondering about a whole lot of different questions, such as how do you tell the difference between imagination and reality? How do you know that if you've seen a deity, whether you've imagined it or whether it really has been a visit or visitation? You know, how do you choose a deity? Let's say you have a problem. How do you know whom to approach? You know, what is it? Why is one guru better than another for you? You know, can a guru take back a mantra if you've got a mantra? Those kind of questions I don't think I would have ever even thought of had I not been the insider, you know? So.
And I must say that even reading the intro, it was very clear to me in reading, I believe in the introductory chapter, you state some of those very questions you recapitulate
yeah.
right here. And the questions bespeak someone with a depth and worldview and understanding, understanding from the perspective of a practitioner rather than start off from the perspective of, well, deities don't exist. right. So whether deities exist or not, for the practitioner, they most certainly do. So then only when you expand your horizon to this level, can you ask the very sensible question, how does one choose one's deity?
Exactly. You have to go all those various steps to the other side. And then that's when you get those questions, because otherwise you don't, you know. Yeah.
That's absolutely fascinating. So maybe
Raj, can I just say one more thing? You know, you talk about how I've, it's absolutely an academic work. I believe scholarly work on mantra. But the reason I have some autoethnography in it, two reasons. One is just disclosure, you know, it's transparency and disclosure. I need to make sure that I'm not hiding that. And the second thing is, the external reviewers asked for it. Well, I had a certain extent of disclosure, but the external reviewers who looked at the manuscript said, well, does the author actually has she had any visionary experience? Can she share anything about her own experience, etc.? So I reconsidered that and I decided to include something that was relevant. While I've actually not disclosed everything, obviously, because it's not about me, it's about mantra. And the last thing I wanted to do was create some kind of fetishizing about what happened to me, you know, because that's not even the point. So I was not doing that. But the very, very keen interest from the readers of the manuscript made me sort of include some parts like that.
I think the line is straddled quite well. I think it's possible for authors to straddle that line irresponsibly. And the scholarship is either not rigorous or it takes on a confessional tone, whereas you have provided some very key insights into drawing on three case studies. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you are forthcoming with the fact that you yourself have practiced and experienced the efficacy of mantra recitation. So the book is called Living Mantra. Why this title? Tell us about this. I take it as a double entendre, but I'll leave it to you to tell us about this title.
One of the themes of the book is about how tradition is dynamic, and the tradition of revelations is an ongoing. It's an ongoing tradition. That it's not something that's thousands of years sort of in the can, you know. When we talk about the word rishi, one immediately thinks of some guy with like a top knot and a beard and probably wearing orange or sitting under a tree or so on, like a sage, you know. The idea is a sage, and they're always called sages. But in fact, rishi means a person who sees. Rish comes from drish, which is to see. And anybody with inner vision is a rishi. And when I started researching the experience of mantra, what actually gave me a focus was discovering that revelations are actually ongoing right now. And it was a chance conversation where I was talking to a Vedic pandit. And, we were arguing or debating, whatever you'd like to call it. And I said, look, you know, you've been doing sadhana you've been doing Vedic mantra since you were a child, since you were put in Veda Parshala, and now you're like almost 70. And you're still telling me about Dirghatamas and Angiras and all this. And I said, what have you discovered? You know, have you seen anything? I mean, where is the Veda? Because you're saying it's anadi, it's anantam, that is without beginning or end. And we talk about how it is, we only have so many shakhas, so many branches, 13 branches out of like the Bhagavatam talks about thousands or over 1,000. And we talk about how all these branches have been lost. And if they've been lost, you know, where are they? Is it lupta means it's lost. Supta is like sleeping, or even gupta is hidden. So I said, you know, we don't know what it is. And you're saying it's there. So where is it and how come you've never found it? And he said, oh, it is possible. And he gave me a PDF file with a documentation of a number of mantras that were muttered by a person called Daivarata when he was in deep meditation. Now, Daivarata is a disciple of Ganapati Muni, who is a disciple of Ramana Maharishi. Many people know, would recognize the name Ramana Maharishi. And this boy, when he was in Samadhi, in meditation, in deep meditation, was found to be muttering all these mantras, and his guru, Ganapati Muni, documented them, recorded them, and there are over 400 mantras. And teams of scholars have looked at this and found that it has all the characteristics of Vedic mantras. So anyway, he gave me all that information, and then I started looking at it and going deeper. And as I started doing that, I'm like, wait a minute, this is not even a century old. This is 1968, this publication. And that means, you know, we think about the Veda as something that was revealed thousands of years ago, and it's technically a closed canon. And I said, what about this? This is not available. I mean, it's not actually part of any extant canon. So what's going to happen to this? And he said, well, there's a grassroots movement about trying to include it in the Atharvaveda. And that actually was my very first piece of information that told me that there's something else going on ground. And in my field work, I started looking around with that in my mind, and one after the other, I started discovering people who were receiving mantras in their meditations.
Fascinating. That's fascinating. So for our listeners, some of you may be specialists, some of you may be educated lay folks. Now, one of the fundamental differences, 30,000 foot view world religions, one of the fundamental differences between Western religion or Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, is that the canon is closed, the revelation is closed, the divine has spoken, and now we have to do our best to sort out what he has said until the end of days. In Indian religions, in Hinduism, the revelation, the canon may be closed, the Vedic canon may be closed, but the revelation is open. The divine will participate and speak to various people at various times. And now we're learning through this research that there are practitioners who, from their perspective, have received revelation on par with the 3,000-year-old Vedic corpus. They've received, in their perspective, Vedic mantra. And so this is obviously a fascinating find. Can you say a little bit more about how what you saw on the ground, we'll dig into some of the specific case studies, but yes, how what you saw on the ground differed from what perhaps Orthodox Hindus or scholars of Hinduism accept as canonical Hinduism?
Yes. Well, first of all, let me clarify that actually my fieldwork was eventually in three locations that were more classifiable as Tantra rather than Veda. Even though the first example I gave was that of Vedic mantras, it is actually Tantric mantras that I have done field work on.
Sorry to interrupt. Just for our audience,
yes,
who may or may not associate Tantra with various practices in the public imagination, say a little bit about what you mean by Tantra versus Vedas in this context.
Okay. Vedic mantras have tones, swaras, and they are a particular body of a certain ancients, I would say. Whereas Tantra is... And those Vedic mantras are usually like more like hymns, where you have several lines and you have sort of meaningful in some way or the other combinations of sounds, which may be words, which are words and lines. Whereas tantric mantras include hymns as well as syllabic mantras. They may be very short. They may be just a few syllables, they may address very specific deities. It's considered a different tradition, and that is also I've also explored a little bit about differentiations and distinctions between the two, what are considered two entirely different practices or traditions. I've explored the relationship a little bit in the conversations as well.
So
I don't know if that helps. I'm sorry. I was trying. How do I say it? How simply can I say it? Yeah.
It certainly does help. So if I were to simplify, really what we're doing is we're oversimplifying, but it's needed at times to start grappling with these concepts. But so Vedic recitation involves different tones, specific melodies, and it's usually a hymn. So there may be a hymn to Lakshmi called the Shri Suktam that goes on for 15-20 verses.
Yes. Correct? Yes.
And so a hymn would be a praise in full sentences to the goddess Lakshmi or Shri, versus a tantric mantra would be simply a short sounds. And some of the sounds may not even have semantic meaning that we call bija, seed sounds, correct?
But tantric mantras also are, like the Saundar Lahari is tantric, which is like several verses, right? The Lalita Sahasranamam is 1,000 names of Lalita, and that's lengthy as well. So there are longer tantric mantras. They're called mala mantras, right? And then there are bija mantras, which are the syllable-based mantras. I think you explained it very well. Yeah.
and so now that we've made this podcast into an intro into an intro Hinduism class, you were saying back to your book the difference that you found on the ground versus maybe what's accepted as canon.
Yes, correct. It's very interesting that people are practicing mantras and in the ways that are given to them by their gurus. A guru is a teacher. And I found that there were communities of practice, right? And I call them mandalas in my book. A group of people and who consider one person as their guru will start sort of following the mantras initiated by that guru to them. And that guru would have possibly received those mantras in their meditative states. Often, if it is a set of mantras or mantras that are, let us say, already known, let's say it's a mantra like Om Namah Shivaya, which is everybody says Om Namah Shivaya. So it's not like somebody's going to invent that mantra. But still, there is something called achieving an authority to pass that on. So the person who has the power to give initiation of that mantra to a disciple would have attained a certain mastery of that mantra and the ability to harness its potency. So that's very interesting. Also, like, let's say there's the Parashurama Kalpa Sutra, right? Which is like a source text, okay? Text not used in the literary sense, but let's say it's a source of utterances, okay? And, but still the mantras being practiced by people will be the version that is given to them by their guru of the Parashurama Kalpa Sutra, because the guru would have gone through the Parashurama Kalpa Sutra and made his or her decisions about what they want to consider as the source text. So in fact, what you're finding is there is a formation of authority out there, right? And that authority and the authorization comes from the poetics of experience of a visionary. And then that visionary passes it on to their students, who then further discover their own revelations. So then the guidance for what they're going to do comes from within the practice. And it's really fascinating to see how then practice starts shaping theory. Because, for example, I met one practitioner who told me how he was trying permutations of the Panchakshari. You know, he told me how if you do a different permutation, a different vision occurs. He gave me examples of what he had practiced and what he found. What efficacy different combinations of syllables had. And these are all his own discoveries. Now, of course, obviously, they are subjective, but if he is then going to pass that on to somebody else, that person will then start experimenting with that, you know? So this is a completely on-ground tradition. I met a very interesting practitioner, Swami Madhavananda, who told me about how he was going into the pranava, which is the om sound, omkara, and he was meditating on different fragments of that. He talked about the many different parts to it with great detail. And I said to him, you know, I have not actually come across anything like this. I mean, I've read the Bindu Upanishad, I've read this, I've read that, I've read this. I've not come across so many different fragments to it. You know, he was talking about meditating on the resonance of the undertone of a part of Om, you know, and he broke it up into all the different parts and began to explain it to me. And he said, oh, it's not written anywhere, of course. It's in the Shruti, but by that he meant that it's actually in the tradition that passes on from one to another. He said he got it from his guru and it's practiced on ground, you know?
So there's a couple of key themes here. We'll talk broad strokes and then maybe we'll look at some of the specific data and the differences across the three sites you visited. But okay. Some of the common themes and these probably match up fairly well with your concluding remarks, but some of the common themes that we see across your study of mantric recitation is the importance of initiation of the mantra within the dynamic of a guru-disciple relationship.
Yes.
From a qualified, authorized teacher, a guru,
yes.
And that this itself constitutes a parampara, a sampradaya.
Yes.
A lineage. Parampara means lineage, but literally it means from one to the other, and that this on the ground transmission from guru to disciple, generation after generation, this constitutes something that is living and dynamic and profoundly either elucidates or contradicts what we see in textual sources.
Absolutely. Though, of course, the guru-disciple transmission is intrinsic to Tantra practice itself, right? Because Tantric mantras are generally passed on from a guru to a disciple. But what I'm saying is that the variations that are passed on, the original, original within quotes, the original mantras that are passed on, you know, the like the guru who decodes new mantras from inside the Lalita Sahasranamam and then publishes a book about it. And then it then circulates to thousands and thousands of people who all start like practicing those mantras, you know. All of this is new material.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is part of the glory, I think, the messiness and the glory of a,
yes.
a living, dynamic religious tradition such as Hinduism, yeah. where yeah. it's ongoing.
But, you know, the thing is, Raj, I had always thought that that was true of the Itihasa Purana, which is the epic histories, the Ramayana and Mahabharata. I had never known, and of course, I had not met anybody who had ever thought that, you know, even the mantra tradition was not exactly like that. I guess the epic histories are include author voices and imaginations and improvisations and so on. But this kind of seems to be very solidly grounded in experience and in visionary experience, you know. So it's not like they are making up mantras, but it's like they have to go really deep into practice and practice sometimes for years and years and even decades. Actually, it's not time. That's silly. It's not even the time. It's there are so many factors, but they seem to absolutely come out with what they have received or what has been revealed. So they are natural forms rather than composed and forms. They're not compositions. They are revelations. And that is the difference between, I guess, this tradition and the Itihasa Purana tradition. I guess some would argue that even that is revealed, but I'm just talking about the mantra, right?
Yeah, I think that works like your study really demonstrate this idea that is much more of than an idea. This idea of open revelation that the revelation of concepts, deities, insights, mantras is ongoing, and there isn't a specific epoch or a specific class of people necessarily that have a monopoly on that, although clearly on the ground in mainstream Hinduism, there of course is a very classist structure to a monopoly on religious authoritative knowledge. But in your study, we can get into the specifics of what you see from site to site.
Yeah.
But it really does strike me as fascinating that there aren't these stringent boundaries. You know, many of the sadhakas, the practitioners you interviewed, were women. Some of them were Westerners, even, who had done practice, such as I think Dawn was one of the ones in the book. And this seems to be very organic and very case-to-case.
Yeah.
And whatever the guru's requirements or criteria for initiation are, they certainly don't seem to be, gender, class, race type thing.
Oh, absolutely not. It is all based on individual experience. But you know, Raj, you were talking about, the perceptions in scholarship. But you know, it's also the perceptions in much of urban India, and there is a sense that that this whole idea of revelation and mantra and all this is from thousands of years ago, when the world was probably different, or nobody knows if it was either composed or revealed, and you kind of like keep on repeating that. But the point is that that's not actually the case. It's only when I started traveling and going, I guess, sort of off the standard route that I started finding that I wouldn't even call it a subculture. I would say it's just a huge culture of this, you know. Mm-hmm. So while you and I might say, oh, mantra, oh, let's say in Ramayana, you know, the Bala Ati Bala mantra, etc. You know, our examples might be from really ancient legends, right? But the people out there in the towns are talking about the Chandol Shastri who lives in the village right next to them, and what happened to their uncle who went and met him, and then, you know, the goddess who visited him, and you know, and then who saw her, etc. They're talking about events from the last few decades, and they've all got stories and legends and experiences and so on about the efficacy of mantra. And mm-hmm. that is also why they continue the tradition, not because somebody told them about something that happened thousands of years ago, which sort of has turned into a TV series, but what they actually have right palpably right next to them.
The power of living mantra, right? That is something very much, I take it as a pun in that it's the mantra is alive, it's a living mantra. And also, it's something one does. These folks are living mantra.
So the three, you asked me about the specific locations. The three, there are three different chapters in the book. One is based on a community in a place called Devipuram, which is south of Visakhapatnam in Andhra Pradesh. All the three locations are in Andhra. And in this particular location, the guru is somebody who was a nuclear physicist. Actually, I don't know if you can be a nuclear physicist in the past tense. I guess once you're a nuclear physicist, you're always a nuclear physicist, maybe. But he was a nuclear physicist by profession. And then he had a visionary experience and then sort of slowly got into goddess worship. And he constructed he's created a temple in the shape of a Shri Yantra, which is a triangular. When you see it from the sky, it exactly looks like a Shri Chakra. Now, Shri Chakra is a diagrammatic embodiment of the goddess. It's made of triangles that are intersecting each other. And that was the first location. The second location was in Guntur, where there is a temple called the Swayam Siddha Kali Peetham, where I have to say the story is, because I didn't see it, is that the image materialized in front of a group of people. What a person said to me was, one moment she was not there, and the next moment she was there, which is the deity in that temple. Materialized out of nowhere. That's the Swayam. So it's called Swayam Siddha. That is self-manifested, self-made. Kali is the name of goddess. The third place is a place called Nachiketa Tapovan, which is south of Hyderabad, about 80 kilometers south of Hyderabad, where there is a community of people who are engaged in community activities, and sadhana or spiritual practice is part of their philosophy together with their activities. It's a more yoga-based tradition there, I would say.
So that these three case studies provide on the one hand a a great deal of diversity in terms of what you're encountering. And then ironically, despite the diversity, you really get a sense of the themes that run across.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah.
It was there, and I'm sure you must have had a lifetime in each of these sites. Now, was there a specific site that maybe spoke to you or called to you personally a little more than any of the other ones?
Yeah, well, it was Nachiketa, and it was because, I guess, it's because I probably didn't have the ability to really connect with the more ritualistic approach of, let's say, this Vayam Siddha Kali Peetham. And where is it Nachiketa? I think it was also partly the personal relationships that sort of like the rapport that just like happened. And with one particular person there, the guru, one particular guru there, from whom I also got mantra initiation. And so that became the location where I actually was doing a lot of my own experimenting, if you want to call it that, or you can just say sadhana, because after a point, I think I just simply became sincere. At the beginning, I certainly was experimenting at the beginning. And then as I got deeper into it, I also came to a point where I just had to put my recorder aside and my notebook aside and really genuinely sort of get into the skin of a practitioner. So that was Nachiketa Tapovan, south of Hyderabad. Yeah.
Wonderful. There really is a difference from being in observer mode to being in immersion mode. And it's exponentially more so in your case when you are at these sacred sites, both practicing and researching how folks practice and what they experience. But even on a much more mundane level, when one goes into a temple to have visitation or to have darshan of the deity, or when one goes into a temple with an iPhone to take pictures to send back to mom or dad It's a drastically different experience when one goes into an experience directly versus when one goes into the experience in a mediated way with an agenda, albeit an intellectual agenda. So I can only imagine that at some point you were like, I'm going to pick up the mala, the rosary, and I'm going to put aside.
I know, and it would always be like, wait, is something happening? No, nothing happened. Or yes, something, did I imagine it? Did it happen? You know, it's just like this whole dialogue. It's beyond a point, it's no use because you can't really do experience. Well, I mean, you can't research an experience until you actually experience without the research. So it's like a contradiction, you know.
My favorite analogy for this divide is being is doing music theory, or even versus playing an instrument, or you're doing ethnography of how folks learn to play their instrument, what they feel when they play their instrument.
Right.
You will necessarily pick up your instrument, and it may or may not map directly onto your method of study.
Yeah.
However, there's only so much that you can sit by the banks and study people swimming before you decide to hop in yourself.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, it's so interesting it was because, in fact, one of the themes that emerged was all about practice and theory itself. So even though, I mean, when we talk about the immersion, in fact, the immersion was a way to discover that the other practitioners are researchers themselves, you know. Because what are they discovering? Is they're discovering new things about mantras, you know? So they're discovering the poetics of practice, and that's what it becomes theory eventually. Because when you look at scholarship on mantra, you find, you find scholarship of two kinds, I would say, in modern scholarship, right? There's one kind that recapitulates what did Anandavardhana say, or what did this source say, like from centuries ago, and so on. The second kind sort of looks at mantra through other lenses, such as, let's say, speech act theory or, semiotics or whatever. But the point is, the person who is doing mantra is not doing it because it's a speech act. They're not, you know, they're not embodying like a different discipline. For them, a deity is reality, you know, is not an aesthetic object.
Right. And irrespective of whether or not, obviously, the approach to that reality is a subjective experience that can be verified empirically. But having said that, there's great intellectual fruit in thinking alongside folks who have those experiences.
But also, they will be the future texts.
Exactly.
Because what we are studying today is, which what we call theory, has come out of their, like, let's call it offtakes of practice. And so whatever the offtakes of practice are now will become future theory. So we can't be 15 centuries out of date when we're studying mantra. So in fact, even though I was finding an immersion, it was really actually the immersion that helped me to re-theorize mantra based on the fieldwork. So the last chapter, which is understanding mantra again, in which it's a respectful homage, let's say, to that famous book called Understanding Mantra, which, you know, is fantastic. But what I did was understanding mantra again, meaning how do you wipe off what's on the blackboard for a short period of time? Just look at the information from the fieldwork. Is it what can I reconstruct about mantra based on this understanding? And that's what that chapter was.
Well, it's obviously your approach of having a practice and having that perspective alongside your study of mantric practice. Your approach befits the topic itself. Yes, it's not going to be arguably, it would be a great challenge to grapple with such a topic without any kind of experience of what happens when someone sits and does a recitation.
Yes.
Arguably, sitting there and even saying Om Namah Shivaya 100 times, whether you're a believer or not, but just going through the hoops even, will give you a perspective of psychologically what happens to an individual, physiologically what happens to an individual. What is that experience like, and how far can one take it? So I think you straddle the line well, and I think it's particularly apropos to the topic, which is why you probably had some illumination where others may not have, because of your specific practices and also your obvious tight relations to the folks that you were interviewing. One theme that comes to mind that I would like to touch on, we talked about, or alluded to at least, the guru-disciple relationship. I would like to talk a little bit about the primacy of sound in the Hindu tradition. Okay. That's something that I think is very important. And then there's another topic that I would love to hear your thoughts on, and it's this little thing called embodiment. It's a topic that comes up over and over again, and maybe you could even specifically draw on Devi Puram, the first site you were at.
A primacy of sound. You know, sometimes people talk about sound and vision like they are competition to each other, and one wonders whether, is this more a sound based tradition or a vision based tradition? And when you really look at it, actually, they're both involved in vision. In vision as in visionary experience, or in understanding is knowledge, or when perception or awareness or information, let's call it information, is both sound and vision. And in the mantras that Daivaratha came up with, if you look at the internal evidence of that, you will see that all the senses are actually engaged, right? So it is true that I actually started my journey by going into the sound. And then, you'll see that a lot of the discussion is about vision in the book. You know, is vision visual? Is it optical? And, you know, or if it is not, what form is it in? And what is actually mantra? I mean, because syllables obviously have sounds, and then, but then how do they receive it? In what form, you know? And some have talked about seeing scripts and not just hearing it in their inner ear, but actually seeing the written form. So I guess even for mantra, I'm not going to be partial to one or the other. It seems to be more of an understanding, which then translates as sound and vision. So deity is, of course, a visual form. Some practitioners did describe how when they did mantras, they saw the deity forming. So you could say that the mantra formed the deity, or the sound formed the vision, right? And that sound was a sound form of the visual form. There seem to be so many variations. So I wouldn't actually agree that the Indian tradition has got more of a primacy of sound. I don't think I would have a decision either way on that.
The relationship is more complex, it seems, between the visual and the auditory. Now, would you agree that there's an obvious emphasis on embodiment at these sites?
Yes, 100%. Particularly in Devipuram, where the temple itself is in the form of a yantra, the diagrammatic. It's an iconic form of the deity. People seem to realize the goddess within themselves, and they seem to experience the yantra as themselves. Meaning, because in the structure of a tantric practice, the worshipper begins with arriving at a point of identification with the deity and then proceeding to worship the deity. So you're worshiping yourself, or you're worshiping the deity in you, or you in the deity, or however you wish to create that connection. But the specifics of the experience that I heard in the narratives were completely like each one was different, and the way that the embodied experience was narrated. For example, one practitioner saw the yantra as cut up triangles inside her body. Another practitioner placed himself mentally, visually, inside the yantra, which is the three-dimensional yantra, and he would sort of walk up and down the yantra, almost placing the mantra at the location of each of the deities who was positioned at different locations in that yantra. A third practitioner had a problem, and then him and his wife drew a yantra in their room and sat on the yantra and did they did the mantra millions of times. So the way that and the yantra is the goddess, it's not a symbol of the goddess, right? So it seems to be sort of a mapping of the body of the practitioner with the deity, which is also the sacred location. The guru of Devipuram, Amritanandanath Saraswati, actually in the very first experience that he had, that he describes in his memoirs, is how he had a vision of being the sacrifice. He was the sacrifice. He was the offering, and then he felt a heavy object in his heart. And then subsequent to that, he finds on the spot that he meditated at, he finds a Mahameru, like an actual three-dimensional yantra buried at the spot. So the vision that he has is actualized by the actual embodied deity object. That then becomes the site of the temple where everybody who goes there, who gets a Kalavahana puja, sits upon that spot and receives the Kalavahana puja. So you receive the puja, puja means worship. In the Kalavahana ritual, you are worshipped, or rather the deity in you is worshipped. And in fact, I think if I'm not mistaken, there's a line in Devi Puram which says that you are Devi Puram, and that it's something like that. It sort of identifies the practitioner with the location. It's a very embodied practice.
Hmm. Now, speaking of location, one of the things you said you found surprising in your conclusion was the extent to which folks actually physically travel to a location to participate.
Yeah.
In recitation or to receive initiation in this day and age where you and I are, I'm currently in Toronto and you're currently in Bangalore, and we are communing via technological means. And you found that surprising.
Because I had already thought that, you know, sort of digital, there's so many people researching digital puja and digital worship and so on, that I guess exactly as you're saying, like our conversation, which is happening, I don't know, is it like a 10-hour time difference?
I'm just
surprised to see it sort of like how the physical plays such an important role, you know. It's almost as if it's almost like a habitat, you know, like you go to a bird sanctuary because the bird, you're going to find the birds there. It's almost like they're going to that spot. Like, why do people go and sit at a samadhi to do their meditation, you know, because there is something in that location that makes it conducive to get faster focus. And if the deities are, it's almost like the deities are hanging around at that spot if you want to go and catch them there.
Well, yeah, exactly. This brings up questions of sacred space. And for example, in Hinduism, we have the Shaktipithas, you know, spot where it is understood that the goddess resides throughout India, which is quite fascinating. And I think the emphasis on locale is yet another extension of the emphasis on embodiment. To be there in person, in front of someone in person. Now, imagination. There's some really, really fascinating insights about imagination and the role of imagination and the construction of imagination for mantric recitation and beyond. Tell us about imagination.
Wow. You know, it's really fascinating how important it is. Intentionality. It's called sankalpa, which is a creative, generative intention, an imagination with a very deeply felt imagination, and how that is crucial to manifestation. It's not just about uttering something mindlessly. Well, actually, it is mindlessly because you are supposed to be kind of empty-minded. But I mean, uttering something, but putting a directed intention in combination with that utterance, that is, seems to be part of the poetics of practice to achieve efficacy of a mantra. To the extent that, you know, there is mantra sahita and mantra rahita, meaning with mantra and without mantra sadhana. So you can do sadhana without mantra. I mean, mantra is not crucial to achievement in sadhana. And in my exploration and thought on this whole topic, I sort of found that, you know, it's not, you, there seem to be so many different levels. I mean, of course, there is the articulated mantra, and then there is the mental mantra, but there also seems to be a no mantra, you know, just intention. If you can hold on to that intention, or you can direct your will or directed thought seems to be a mantra in itself. It's so fascinating how practitioners approach it and how far they go with that.
And so that begs the question then, why mantra? I mean, is it such that there are more dynamic experiences, deeper fruits? Like, could you generalize in terms of why mantra? Why would
someone? Oh my God, if I could generalize, Raj, but if I could generalize, I guess it's just easier with mantra because, you know, then you don't, if it's like saying, what can I say? Trying to sit in a room and focus. But the mind is, how is the mind going to focus? Because it's just such a fluid, floating, sort of anchorless thing in itself, you know. So, for example, if you engage all your senses and you're doing bhajans, then it's actually easier to help your mind focus in that direction of that sankalpa, of that thought, of feeling or bhava, feeling of, let's say, if you're doing a bhajan or a mantra to a deity, it's easier to let that meaning and let that utterance and that activity help direct your thought towards that result.
That's fascinating. So definitely for anyone interested in anthropology of religion and ethnography in living tradition, and specifically obviously interested in mantra recitation, definitely check out Living Mantra by Mani Rao. Before we let you go, since we've taken up enough of your time for one day, tell us what occupies you now. What are you working on? What's the next project for you?
I can't talk a lot about it, but I can tell you I have a handful of projects. One is actually it is translator's notebook, sort of translator's notes or notebook. It's a book that draws from my translation of the Gita and goes a little deeper into the number of various questions and problems and failures and speculations and so on of that enterprise.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, that's just one example I can give you. I have another thought, which is about exploring the history of ideas to do with what I'm... And my tentative title is Forbidden Veda. You know, is what is Nishedh? What is forbidden? And like, you know, there are certain prohibitions, such as that women can't recite Veda and so on. So one thought I have is to take that up as a topic and just like really look into both sides on that.
So I would definitely read a book called Forbidden Veda.
the tentative title always has to be provocative. You know?
And maybe it's a Hindu studies nerd joke, but who wouldn't want to read a book called Forbidden Veda? But with any luck, I'll be reading it in preparation for your next New Books Network Hindu Studies podcast interview on Forbidden Veda. It has been. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you.
Insightful. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed talking as well.
Take care.
Thank you.